Let's get started. We just have a little bit more on my lecture, and then I'll be talking about the structure of the CSX grammar, because that's what you'll be working on. So as time ran out in the last session, I was mentioning the fact that grammars are used to define structure. And in some cases, if you're not careful about how grammar is put together, you can create an ambiguity in structure. So let's look at this very simple grammar that seems perfectly reasonable. So this is doing subtraction, and I had addition previously. And if I parse something like A minus B minus C, I have to be careful on how these particular operators, operands are grouped together. Because unlike addition, the order in which you do subtraction makes a big difference. That is, A minus B minus C and A minus B minus C are two different values in general. And a user expecting to have one interpretation would be very disappointed if the other interpretation was really what's implemented. Now, it happens that programming languages have a way of resolving this, but we have to be aware of the danger of ambiguity and a way of using a grammar to force the rules that the language has with respect to the grouping of identifiers. It turns out that our language, like C and Java and C++ and most others, have a rule that both addition and subtraction are what's called left associative. Left associative means if you have more than one operator of the same variety, it's applied in a left to right order. That means A minus B minus C gets that interpretation. What do you say? Well, wait a minute, what if I want the other interpretation? You may have it, but normally you have to force it by using explicit parens. So you certainly could write down that explicitly with the parens typed by you. So one of the things we have to worry about for operators is what's their associativity. Most operators are left associative. That includes addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. A few operators, fortunately not ones that we have, are right associative. It happens that some languages have double star as exponentiation. And if I write down A, double star B, double star C, it means essentially that grouping, right to left rather than left to right. Why is that? I asked one time, and I was told that in mathematics, if you write that down, and you can, oh, and you can almost see it, if I write down A to the B to the C, in mathematics, that means A to the B to the C, rather than the other way around. And historically, I don't know why. It also turns out that a few operators, perhaps surprisingly enough, are non-associative. That means if I write that's not going to be legal. Now, the question is, why in the world would that be the case? Certainly, I can imagine you say something, I want A equals B, I want to find out if A equal to B and B is equal to C. Why would you imagine that a language would refuse to accept that form? There are a few languages, again, that have changed themselves so they do allow it. I think Python, again, is one of those. But C and Java and others won't normally allow that sort of expression. And the reason is, it's because if it allowed it, you'd almost certainly do it wrong. You get other than what you expected. Remember, the way big expressions are typically evaluated is take a piece, evaluate it, get a partial result, and then apply further operators until the whole expression is done. That's precisely what you do with subtraction. I subtract A minus B, get a difference, take that difference, subtract C from it, that's my final result. But suppose I had A equals B equals C, and they're all integers. What it would say is A equal to B or not, that's a Boolean. So it would convert this to true or false. Now, if I'm lucky, it'll give me a type error. I say if I'm lucky because I don't want to compare true against C because C is an integer. And integers being equal to true or false is not anything I want. Some languages I can cast an integer, a Boolean into an integer if I want to force it. But it's in my case if I have to ask for it. So if this were allowed, and it was allowed in earlier languages, I would get something that would say true or false. False is 0, true is 1. So it says A equal to B, get 0 or 1, and compare 0 or 1 against C, which is not what you meant. What you almost certainly meant was A equal B, and B equal C. But this and that are two different expressions. So certain operators, relational operators in our languages, are non-associative. If you really want to force it, you can put parens in there. You may have to do some casting because normally equality will give you booleans, and booleans can't be compared with integers unless you cast. So that's something you'd have to do. So what we want to do is, first of all, determine what structure this grammar right here gives us. And if it turns out to be ambiguous, as it is, I'll explain what that is, how to fix it. So here's the problem. Ambiguity says the same input can be interpreted two different ways. Now again, in human discourse, that's sometimes very useful. In the old days when a politician was campaigning, if the politician was in farm areas, he was all for the farmers. If he was in the city, he was all for the city folk. And if he's with the bankers, he's all for the bankers. Now everybody has YouTube and the like, and it's a lot easier, a lot more difficult to fib. But in this particular case, if I give you ID minus ID minus ID, please, please, please show me how you're going to structure it. Well, it turns out that the structure I gave you has two alternative structures. And I don't know in advance which it's going to give me, and therefore I'm not going to accept either. Here's one, using the grammar I had. It says, okay, first expression becomes the difference of two expressions, and now I can take the left guy, and form AB minus A minus B minus C, or by making a different choice of expansion, I could get an alternative tree structure for A minus B minus C. They're both not equivalent semantically, and therefore, I'd want to have one chosen over another. The problem was the grammar allowed this choice, and it shouldn't have. The good news is that the parsing techniques we're going to use, like JavaCup, will, if it sees a ambiguous grammar, reject it. It's going to say, I cannot parse this grammar. And why? Well, you can kind of see up here why from these two structures. Namely, at some point it has to make a decision. Do I want the left structure or the right structure? But it's got no way to make the choice because they're both valid. It could just flip a coin or some foolish thing like that. But it simply says, unless I can make a unique choice and therefore guarantee that each time I parse, I'll give you the same structure, I'm not going to do it. It happens that that's not as terrible as it might seem because all we need to do is fix the grammar a tad to say, of those two structures, I want one and not the other. And let's go ahead and see how that works. So all I do is change the grammar ever so slightly. And this actually turns out, let's see if we have it on the next slide. Yes, we do. That it can be parsed in only one way, and I'll show you why the alternative parse doesn't work. So it turns out that we can essentially get this structure, the structure on the left, and you can see why that is. Essentially up here, this guy goes to ID immediately using this production, and then that production, and finally identifier. So I do, in fact, get this structure on the left, and that's the one I want. Oh. I gotta have somebody keep an eye on this for me. So I get that structure. Interestingly, I can't get the alternative structure here because what happens here is that if I were to form this structure, I'd have to have an E as the second operand. But notice I can't have the second operand be an E. It's got to be an ID. So the only way I could force that is if I added extra parens, which I don't have in my current grammar. So the takeaway here is that some grammars have this ambiguity problem, and you have to solve it before you can build a valid parser. Good news is that parsers will reject ambiguous grammars. The bad news is the grammar I'm going to give you in a few minutes is ambiguous. It's only slightly ambiguous, only one spot, and I'll talk my way around it. I know it's ambiguous, and I'm giving you to that because it's a common error, and it's something we have to fix. it's not so much the ambiguity is in the grammar, although it is, but it's rather our understanding of how structures are formed. It just turns out that programming languages have evolved in a way that some structures are really ought to have been made differently, but it's way too late to make a change. I've explained one of those to you previously. It's that assignments really ought to be written with the left-hand side and the right-hand side inverted. That is, I really ought to write something like A plus B plus C equals D. That's not the way they're written. Now, always the target is on the left and the source is on the right. But it turns out that when we evaluate these, we always mean evaluate the right-hand side. Why? Because I have to know what value to store into the identifier before I do the store, and then go ahead and do that particular assignment. So writing it the other way around means that we really invert the evaluation a bit. When I write it this way, I sit on D temporarily, evaluate A plus B plus C, and if I had function calls in there, that might take a while. It might be a number of calls. It's a big, long computation. And finally, when all this is done, then I go back to the symbol D, which I skip past, and store it. We can live with that. We obviously have, because programming languages do it routinely. But it's something that, if we had our druthers, and we could go way back in time and change something, that might be one of the things we'd change. It'd certainly be a more honest representation. It's not such a big deal that people worry too much about it, but just deep down, you can see it's really something done wrong. You say, well, that doesn't mean so much, but really, suppose I had something like that's perfectly valid in most languages, and guess what? We will allow that in CSX. You can have arrays, and you can have function calls, method calls, and, of course, addition. Now the problem with our definition is, I said a moment ago, sit on this, but I'm calling f of a, f of b, and f of c, and what nasty thing can functions do that we might not want it to do? Not just declare a variable, change variables. Their functions aren't always pure. They can sometimes change values other than what they're passed. So it's possible that if I, for excuse me, I were a field inside of a class, and this was inside of a method inside the class, that these functions could go ahead and change I as a side effect. It's one of the dangers of subprograms is they have these side effects. Sometimes they're fairly benign. Sometimes they're fairly major. And in this particular case, I'd have to worry definition-wise, do I mean the I before or the I after this particular evaluation? In some cases, what we might actually do is get the value of I and store it away somewhere so it can't be tampered with, then do this whole evaluation of F of A plus F of B plus F of C, which might take many, many steps depending on the complexity. And finally, when you get a value, take the value of A, the value of I, I solved it away so that I get the expected change. Other languages are a little bit weaker about that and say, yeah, you change it, you get what you get. And it's up to you to avoid those sort of dangerous situations. I'm not sure I like that as much, but some languages are a little bit weak in that particular context. So anyway, the notion here is that we're going to have one ambiguity. I'll tell you about it in a few minutes, and I'll then show you in later lectures how to fix it. Before we get to the grammar, because a large portion of the grammar I give you has to do with operator precedence, not only do we have to enforce associativity, that is, expressions have to be formed left to right, typically, or right to left, but there's this other rule, which most of you are probably familiar with, but if you're not, I'll remind you of it, namely that not all operators are created equal. Some operators are more important than others. And if I write down something like this, and this is true in virtually every current language, certainly in C, C++, Java, and even in CSX. I'm sorry, I wanted to star here, didn't I? Yeah. You might think that I'd evaluate this left to right because I said addition and multiplication associate left to right. And that's true, but it's also the situation that operator precedence says multiplication is more important than addition. So the rule of the language says you've got to translate this as if there were parens there, and because multiplication has higher precedence than addition, and then do the addition. The user can always add explicit parens to force the grouping they want. But failing that, you've got to follow these operator precedence rules. And they go several layers deep. This has precedence over this and over that. So we have to write a grammar that if it sees A plus B times C, that it forms a tree structure forcing the multiplication to occur before the addition in the tree, therefore giving that a higher precedence. It's not at all clear you can do that, but you can. And this grammar fragment and the one I'll show you in the full CSX grammar do just that. So let's see how this thing works. So in this particular case, do I have a tree there? Yes, I do. So it says, if I see this particular structure, which do I get? Do I get the addition done first, or do I get the multiplication done first? I want the multiplication done first. So let's go ahead and draw out the grammar. And this E goes to T goes to P goes to ID business is more complex than you would like, but it's done so that I can stratify the levels at which various operators are applied. So plus T. So this is A, B, and excuse me? Yeah, yeah. We need to get somebody to get an air horn or something. And whenever I'm out there, and or maybe what people do with the cats, get one of these spray bottles. Whenever the cat's doing something bad, spray them a little bit and tell them it's time to pay attention. So let's look at this tree structure. Did this do what we wanted it to do? I wanted this to do the multiplication before the addition. And is that what the tree is telling me to do? The answer is yes, because you notice this whole substructure is evaluated before the addition. And that means the substructure involving the multiplication is done first. And then the addition is done afterward, because this substructure and that substructure have to be evaluated before the plus can be applied. But you say to yourself, well, maybe that's just dumb luck. Maybe it's the case that I get the structure I didn't want and have a structure here where the A plus B is done first and the multiplication is done second. Situation like that, which I don't want. And it turns out the grammar should make that impossible. And the reason for that is, if it's the case that I go ahead and do the addition first, if we go back and look at our grammar, if I do addition, the only way I can do addition is by forming an E. So this whole thing, if I do the addition, has to form from an E. But now I want to have the multiplication, and multiplication involves a T. And notice there's only one way to go from a T to a P to an expression, and that's by putting parens around something. So the way this grammar is structured, I cannot accidentally get A plus B done first, because if I did so, it would have to form an E, but then it could not parse the star, because the star will not take an E as a substructure except in parentheses. So the grammar actually forces me to do the organization automatically. That means if I write the grammar down in this form, it'll get associativity and operator precedence done correctly and without any intervention on my part beyond writing the grammar. In fact, this is a good stage then to hand out the grammar and look at it. Now, first thing is don't faint away when you see the number of pages, because most of these are just detail work. I was just trying to project this a little larger because some of the productions are small. Fortunately, you have the paper in front of you. So at this stage, all I want you to look at is the grammar that begins in the middle of page 1 and extends across page 2. And I'll talk a little bit about what the grammar is doing and why things are the way they are. And we'll actually answer some questions about the structure of all this. So the start symbol is program. You look at the very first line, and we start to see what our language looks like. It's like Java. It's class-oriented, so it's got a class, and a class has a name. It then has, inside braces, members. That's exactly like Java. What are members? Well, if you look at members, in the next several lines, there are fields followed by methods. Fields must come first. Unlike Java, where you can mix fields and methods, in our language, it's a little simpler. Fields come first, and methods come next. Oh, yeah, let's make this class participation. Is it the case that in this language, we talked about an earlier one, that I can have essentially an empty body, that I could have a program that had a class, had a name, and after the braces had nothing inside it? That is it legal to have no fields and no methods? And the answer is yes. And how can we tell that? Well, notice we have members, and members become fields followed by methods. Fields can go to Lambda, and methods can go to Lambda. More typically, you're going to have something that has just a method, possibly no fields, probably not a field with no methods, because one of the auxiliary rules we'll have is that every valid class has to have a method named main. It's exactly like Java, because that's where things begin. But that has to do with semantic processing. But in this case, our definition says you don't have to have that at the syntactic level. And you'll see why we have that when we get the blocks. So the first thing we learn is we have fields and methods. What do methods look like? Not too much different than what we're accustomed to. They have begin with a type. Void means I return nothing. And I can also return a type. And the next page says types are integer, character, and Boolean. We could have more, but that's sufficient for our purposes. Methods may have no arguments. And if I have no arguments, you have empty pair of parens. Or I can have some arguments, and I declare them as their appropriate type. Inside of a method, I have fields and statements. And let's look up statements to see. Let me get ahead of that. Statements is on the next page, I believe. And if you look at the very top of the very next page, the second line says statements go to Lambda. So it is, in fact, the case that I can have an empty list of statements. That means I got to have an empty method body. Not so sure if that's cool or not, but it's something that's allowed. And our grammar tells us that. Continuing down, let's look at arguments. Okay, we have a type, and we know about types identifier. What are these square brackets all about? What are they telling us? That we can have an array parameter. Like most languages, if I pass an array parameter, I don't know its size. In Java and in our language, the size of an array is a property of the object. So I can't tell you how big it's going to be. It's going to be whatever it was when it was created and passed to me. But it's saying, hey, this guy is an array, and that means I can do sorts and all the other kind of cool routines that take an array and manipulate data. So it's a rich enough language for that. I have fields that have a type and identifier. It can be initialized with an expression. I can have an array. Its size is fixed by an integer literal. That's kind of like C. I can't have a computation. I simply say its size is 10 or 50 or 100. That's a simplification, but it's not a terribly unreasonable one. And I can have a constant where I give a name to a particular value. And that's useful in languages. I get down to, let's get the other way around. Let's look at our statements, and here's where our ambiguity is. So statements are a list of statements. Notice that business I had about semicolon at the end of statements follows in. That means I'm thinking of semicolon as a terminator rather than a separator. Happens in experience-wise, most people do tend to think of it that way, so we're able to handle that. Let's see what we got. We got if statements, if then else, while. I can put a label on a while loop because I can do breaks and continues into or out of that loop, or out of that loop, I guess. I have an assignment. I have iteration of an identifier, increment and decrement. Different than most language, I have increment and decrement at the statement level, not at the expression level. Can anybody guess why that's the case? Well, increment and decrement at the expression level are side effects. And side effects inside of an expression get us back to just that sort of problem that I was talking about earlier, namely the order in which things are evaluated. And that makes things a little bit difficult. But we do have increment and decrement, and it turns out one of the nice things about doing increment and decrement at the statement level is that I can get away from the notion of exactly what values return. Remember, statements don't return values. They just have a side effect. And that turns out to be fairly important because one of the more common ways of using an increment is that. It says, please increment I by 1. But it turns out in C and in C++ that there are two versions of increment. There's a pre-increment and a post-increment. And what's the difference between those two? That's right. It's a question of whether you see the increment or not. And here's one of the interesting little anomalies in programming language history. Everybody's heard of C++. Where did the plus plus come from? This, of course. But it turns out that C++ is really misnamed. C++ was supposed to be a new and improved C, an improvement upon C, like an increment. Except if I have a post increment, what's the definition of a post increment? It says take the value like I or C, increment it, and what do I return? The old value. Now it turns out you say, oh my God, how could they possibly do that? Well, the fellow who actually designed the language is a guy named Bjarni Sustrup, something like that. And this fellow actually visited Madison once. And I was at dinner with him and like 1,000 people before. And we said, you know better than this. Why in the world did you misname C++? And he had a very good, but now kind of an out-of-date reason for naming C++ as he did. Can anybody guess why he named it that? Knowing it was really wrong if you understood the semantics of increment. It's because he was worried that books about C++, if it was called plus C, would be mislabeled on library shelves. And he probably would. C++ is bound to be on a typical library near C. But plus, does anybody know library science? If you have plus C as a title, where would it go? It could go as special symbols, or you could spell out P, the plus sign is plus, but you also might spell it out as A. So I guess it could go in the A section, the P section, or I guess the special symbols are at the past the Z's. So, and the funny thing about it is that historically it doesn't make much sense anymore. When was the last time you were in a library professionally? For me, it's been a long time. You know, that's what you have Google for, and that's what you have the internet for. I go to libraries sometimes, you know, to get a copy of the latest adventure novel or something that I'm too cheap to buy, but that's something different. So at any rate, we have increment, and we now know why C++ is the way it is. We have read and print. We have subprogram calls. We have return, possibly with expressions, breaks, and continues. And we have an ambiguity. And I think I have just enough time to show it to you, and then we'll talk about fixing it next time. Here's the problem. As our grammar, and look at the first two if definitions to see the problem. If I have something that has more ifs than else's. So I have two ifs and one else. How is that to be interpreted? Notice that it can be interpreted two different ways. This can be interpreted as, if this B is true, then do this part, else if B is false, do the else part. That's one interpretation. But the other one is, if B, then do this whole shebang, and inside that evaluate C and do P1, else P2. And guess what? The two productions I have there allow either interpretation. That's ambiguity. Well, what's the problem on this? Well, the problem is people are allowed to write programs that have structures like this, where I don't always have to have an equal number of else's and ifs. It happens that language definers have come up. Let's see, how are we doing on time? I see people packing up. So I guess I'm all over time, aren't I? Sorry about that. So I'll explain next time what the solution is for this. I put it in because historically this is a long-standing problem and it represents something where we'll have to do a little grammar engineering to fix it all. So I'm sorry I ran over, but I was ahead of timing, so I wanted to get to at least that. So we'll see you next week already. Hey, cool.